maybe 30 or 20 years ago, a Saudi might have said, I'm Muslim and I'm Arab and I'm Saudi. Now they might say, I'm Saudi and I'm Arab and I'm Muslim.
You know, they're trying to radically refashion their country and they need help from the best experts in the world. Do you want to have your country's people be disqualified from that because of some essentially antiquated point of view about how countries work together?
In recent months, it can feel like Saudi Arabia is intent on buying the world. It's bought up much of golf, sports teams, many of the globe's best soccer players to its own domestic league, and it owns huge chunks of many of the biggest companies on the planet. But Saudi Arabia is not just on a shopping spree. The once insular, oil-rich kingdom is transforming into a major diplomatic and military player, a pivotal actor in the energy transition, and looks set to host high-end cultural events like the FIFA World Cup.
You know, they know that buying a football club immediately brings you a billboard into a global game that allows you to completely reposition yourself and rebrand yourself.
It feels like we're entering the era of the Saudi project. But what exactly is the kingdom trying to achieve, and will it succeed? Coming soon from Intelligence Squared, The Saudi Project is a new podcast series seeking to answer some of these questions and more.
Britain does have choices. It's not either-or situation. We either indulge Mohammed bin Salman or boycott Mohammed bin Salman. There is a third choice.
Search The Saudi Project wherever you get your podcasts.
What can you do when your friends get sick of you prying into their problems?
Do what everyone else is doing, of course. Start a podcast.
Introducing If I Speak, a brand new podcast from me, Ash Sarkar.
And me, Moya Lothi McLean, where we pitch each other our big theories about the universe, share the intrusive thoughts keeping us up at night, and best of all, tackle your personal dilemmas.
We'll be asking questions like, does tabloid gossip turn us all into conspiracy theorists?
Should you financially support a parent?
Is Moya turning into a bit of a femcel?
Yes. What's Ash's most toxic trait?
Interrupting. From dating disorders to family feuds, career dilemmas to online etiquette.
The political gets personal on If I Speak.
Find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you get your podcasts.
It's gossip elevated.
Hello and welcome to this episode of Intelligence Squared. I'm lead producer Catherine Hughes. Today we bring you a thought-provoking discussion with renowned journalist and best-selling author Sathnam Sangara, where he delves into patriotism, the culture wars, and the nuanced narratives of the British Empire and its forgotten and often purposefully destroyed history. Sangara is joined by fellow journalist and author Kavita Puri, prior to the release of his latest children's book, Stolen History. This episode was recorded on the 17th of May, 2023. To listen ad-free and to support our mission to foster honest debate and compelling conversations, head to intelligencesquared.com/membership. Let's join Sathnam and Kavita now in conversation.
Hello and welcome to Intelligence Squared with me, Kavita Puri. And I am very excited to introduce our guest, Sathnam Sangara, Times journalist, best-selling author. His books include The Excellent The Boy with a Top Knot, Marriage Material, and of course, Empireland, which was longlisted for the Bailey Gifford Prize for nonfiction and won the Nimbys Book of the Year for nonfiction. His new book, which we'll be discussing, is Stolen History, The Truth About the British Empire and How It Shaped Us. It's an introduction to the British Empire for readers aged 9 and over, but actually, I think it's great for anyone who wants to learn about empire and maybe was too afraid to ask some difficult questions. Sathnam, welcome.
Hello.
Like you, actually, I worked out really late on in my life about empire, why I'm here, why my parents came to Britain. And reading this book, I felt it's the book I wish I always had when I was growing up. I imagine it's the book that you wish you had when you were growing up.
Yeah, totally. I mean, I didn't learn the basics of British Empire to my 40s. Didn't study a single writer of colour until my final term at Cambridge. And I guess one of the biggest lessons I've learned from writing Empireland is we are a multicultural society because we had a multicultural empire, which counteracts the narrative I grew up with, which is that brown people came here uninvited and took advantage of British hospitality. That's been the narrative about imperial immigration during my lifetime, and certainly in Enoch Powell's Wolverhampton when I grew up. And I think if I'd known that we're here for a reason, for deep reasons, it would have changed my entire sense of myself in Britain for the better. And the idea of giving kids that knowledge feels amazing, but also makes me jealous and slightly angry that I never had that.
But also important not just for kids who are brown to know that, but for other kids to know that history too. It's their history, right?
Absolutely. And a lot of the main narratives we have about ourselves, like World War One, World War Two, the Tudors, there were imperial elements to those stories, right? The millions of black and Asian soldiers in World War One and World War Two, the black figures who were in the courts of Henry VII and Henry VIII. And it was never mentioned. I sat through dozens of Remembrance Day services throughout my youth. No one ever said, oh, your people were there too, you know? And again, I think it would have been a really powerful thing to tell a racially diverse school like mine.
It's odd because, like you, as I say, I came to it late on in my life, in my 40s too. It's weird, isn't it, to have this kind of revelation, this knowledge so late on?
It is weird. The amnesia is just absolutely bizarre. And like the number of Oxford educated historians who've been in touch with me to say, oh, I learned nothing about the British Empire until I did it myself in my 30s or 40s is amazing. It's almost like a conspiracy. And I've been writing, I'm writing a sequel to Empireland at the moment. And one thing I've really realised is that there are several reasons for that, the amnesia. But one of them is that the British went out of the way to delete knowledge and delete documentation. I mean, there was a pall of smoke over Delhi because they were burning so many documents on independence. But if you look at what happened during the Mau Mau Rebellion, the British destroyed all the documents. And I've been reading recently about the establishment of Nigeria and like Goldie, not the rapper, the guy who was involved in the foundation of Nigeria, he deleted every single document at the time. Like he knew it would not be favourable. And I think it was pretty systematic.
It's interesting you talk about that amnesia because you explain in the book why children don't know about empire and why people actually might feel quite awkward discussing it. Why was it important to tell children that some people might feel angry when they start a discussion about empire? I mean, you even explain what selective amnesia is to them. Why did you decide to do that and include that?
I mean, I didn't understand the basics of empire until my 40s, but also I'm not an historian. And one thing I didn't understand until I was an adult is that history is argument. I mean, I did GCSE history, but I left school thinking that history was a list of undisputed facts. And that's not true. History is argument based on hard facts. And that is transformative as an idea for me. And I think children can handle it. I think there's no getting over the fact that the empire is at the heart of a culture war in Britain. And I didn't want to pretend otherwise with children because they'll be taking the book back home and their parents might be cross. And I want them to know that actually there are different views. You can make arguments as long as they're based in hard fact. And again, I think that's a kind of life-changing concept.
I mean, you mentioned the culture wars. Do you think this book will be seen as part of the culture wars?
Yeah, I mean, I occasionally get accused of being a culture war, right? But I would say, look, let's look at the culture war and empire. On one side, there's people like me and historians earnestly trying to base what we say on facts and research and consensus. On the other side, you've got the government who have got involved in this culture war with full sincerity and passion. And then you've got powerful think tanks. You've got the right-wing media. I feel pretty outnumbered. So I don't feel like I am the culture warrior. I feel like they are the culture warriors. But this is the nature of culture wars in that both sides accuse each other of being culture warriors. But I would say, you know, in general, I'm trying to reflect what historians think, the experts. On the other side, they're trying to argue against the consensus of what imperial historians think. And it's part of a general battle against the experts. It happened with COVID, it happened with Brexit, and it's happening with history.
Do you feel that the culture wars have entered the classroom? I mean, you travel around schools quite a lot. You talk to teachers, you talk to school children. Do you get a sense that teachers are afraid to teach empire because they'll be, you know, picked up by whichever camp from parents?
I know so, because I spoke to the Historical Association's gathering of many history teachers last week, and they are full of stories like parents coming saying, why are you teaching my children all this fake history about Enoch Powell, who was right? What do you say to that as a teacher? But also, I think there was a survey out a few months ago, people going to libraries saying, why are you even stocking this book? It's woke nonsense. And in Florida, you've got now, you know, books being banned. And I feel like whatever happens with the culture wars over there eventually comes over here. And I feel like that is the next step. And it made me very nervous writing this book, you know, because I know some parents are going to be like, this is nonsense because they're part of the culture wars. And I do acknowledge that our particular brand of racism in Britain, I think, was caused by British Empire. And British Empire was racist. But there is an argument now on the fringes that British Empire was never racist. And problem is, you've got to take that on. You can't gloss over it with kids because the fact is the consensus among every imperial historian I've ever read, including Niall Ferguson, Jan Morris, people who love the empire, is that British Empire was willfully racist for at least a century. And you've got to say it, whatever the people on the fringes might argue.
So I'm sure you know very well that the Home Secretary a couple of days ago, Suella Braverman, said white people shouldn't feel guilty about Britain's history and there is no future without reverence of the past. Do you fear that this book is going to be accused of not being proud enough of Britain by daring to mention the extent of slavery, what the East India Company did, for example?
Of course, I get that all the time. I mean, if you look on my Amazon reviews, loads of people who clearly not read the book giving it one-star reviews saying it's Britain bashing.
Yeah, the book's not out yet, but that's great.
Yeah, actually, no, the book got called Vicious.
Brilliant.
In the Jewish Chronicle by a right-wing journalist about 3 months before I finished it. So that's what you're facing now. I mean, David Olusoga has a bodyguard.
Yeah.
It's full on, the culture wars. It's actually translating into actual, it feels like actual war sometimes. And of course, I'm going to get accused of that. But I think if you understand empire, it's a really positive thing overall. You know, for a start, a lot of British people took on the empire throughout. Secondly, yes, we dominated the slave trade for large periods, but also we abolished it. And I say that in the book. And then we had racism, which was created by empire, but also we have a multicultural society because of empire. Those things can coexist. The problem in the culture wars is that there's no room for nuance.
But you talk about coexistence, and I wonder if with this book, what you're trying to show kids is that you can be proud of your country, but also ask questions about your country. And that's totally, and that's what it's equipping them to do.
Yeah, if you really love your family, I wrote a family memoir. That was an expression of love. I sat there and sat through very difficult stories, things that pained me. But it's because I love my family that I thought it was worthwhile. Similarly with your country. If you truly love your country, you look at the history, warts and all, to understand it, the proper truth, rather than seeing it through a prism of pride or shame, which is bizarre, because, I mean, why would you view history through feelings? Your feelings really do not matter.
And you would consider yourself a patriot, right?
God, yeah, I mean, I am way too right-wing for some people by saying things like that. Well, I'm a centrist, probably. And you know what? This is all quite new. I think the idea that you're not properly British if you dare to observe the massacres and the slavery is it's a modern trope. And again, created by social media, I feel.
Intelligence Squared is a tight-knit team doing big things, and it means we're always looking for tools that can help streamline managing tasks. That's why I want to talk to you for a minute about NetSuite. NetSuite provides cloud-based software to get things moving. Maybe your business has been humming, but you can feel things are falling behind a little bit. Or perhaps your team is getting snowed with manual tasks and closing those books is taking forever. If this sounds like you, you should know these three numbers. 37,000, 25, 1. 37,000, that's the number of businesses which have upgraded to NetSuite by Oracle. 25, NetSuite turns 25 this year. That's 25 years of helping businesses do more with less, allowing them to close their books in days, not weeks, and drive down costs. And one, because your business is one of a kind. So you get a customized solution for all of your KPIs in one efficient system with one source of truth. It means you can manage risk, get reliable forecasts, and improve margins. It's everything you need to grow all in one place. NetSuite is now making an unprecedented offer to make more of that kind of thing possible. Right now, you can download NetSuite's popular KPI checklist designed to give you consistently excellent performance absolutely free at netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared to get your own KPI checklist. netsuite.com/squared. Sponsoring the show for this episode is Marquee TV. Marquee TV is a streaming service with a difference. It's bringing you the top tier of performing arts straight into your living room or onto your device. So think dance, theatre, music, anything you might find in the West End, Broadway, or maybe a cool little experimental space too, but saving you the cost of a few tickets as well. I've got happily a bit lost in their vast library of performances, exclusive interviews, and behind-the-scenes content. Choreographer Jonathan Watkins' interpretation of George Orwell's classic 1984 was pretty cool, and I love the dance piece Sutra, inspired by the skills of Buddhist Shaolin monks. And we've got a special treat for our listeners. Marquee TV offers 3 months of access for just 99 cents. That's right, 3 months for only 99 cents with the code squared. Simply visit marquee.tv and use the promo code squared to dive into the world of arts like never before. Bring the arts home with Marquee TV. We make a lot of stuff here at Intelligence Squared. So many great chats to enrich the mind, like the one you're listening to now. But like any business, it's really essential to be in good shape and keep things efficient, so you can see the big picture all in one place. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you can cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems, and it's super easy to get started because NetSuite exists in the cloud, so no hardware needed, cutting your IT costs too. And you'll also improve efficiency by bringing all your major processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. That's why over 37,000 companies have already made the move. The cost of living crisis might not be making anything any cheaper, but there's real value in feeling on top of things, which is something I experience firsthand as an event producer every day. And now, by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/squared. That's netsuite.com/squared. netsuite.com/squared.
I've seen the kind of stuff that you get on social media. And it's interesting because other historians who are not of colour, who say similar things, don't get any of that. They're certainly not walking around with bodyguards. Do you ever think, actually, it's too much?
Yeah, I do. I actually more or less stopped doing events in Britain because actually the trolling online is I'm so used to it, it doesn't really matter. It doesn't feel real, although it does get you when it's relentless for days at a time when you get targeted. But it's the way it translates into real life. It's people coming to my events and shouting at me. And, you know, when that happens, it always makes for a good event in the sense that other people stand up for me. It feels like the whole event matters. I sell out my books. It's good. I mean, it makes my publisher happy, but it comes at personal cost to me. I realized that I started dreading the moment. I was waiting to be attacked and I just stopped doing those events and I just did international ones. But then I did an event at Jaipur where you were there, and there was a journalist who writes for The Telegraph who wrote a completely skewed version of what happened. You just can't escape it, really. But I'm now going to have to start doing these events. And I think I'm hoping the part of the solution with stolen history is to talk directly to schools and pupils. I find talking to students is much more rewarding than talking to purely nostalgic adults who maybe had a very one-sided education.
I'm surprised to hear you say that you have tried to avoid events here. You have not had death threats, have you? You've not. You don't have a bodyguard.
No, I don't. But, you know, yeah, I mean, I'm not the only one. I do feel like black historians get it worse, and women of colour get it absolutely the worst.
You said you really want to go round schools, and I know you like speaking to school children. Do you think the next generation think differently about empire?
Totally. I get the feeling that they feel about museums and empire in general the way we felt about zoos. I remember going around Dudley Zoo as a kid, thinking, why is this tiger trapped in Dudley, man? It's not right, you know, and I feel like the new generation definitely feel that about museums. You hear them, if you go around the British Museum, first of all, you hear a lot of people from Asia complaining about their precious items being held by the British. But also, I think you hear from children saying quite challenging things, which you didn't hear in my generation. Yeah, they really care about it. I get the sense also a lot of children are going to school and saying, Miss, Sir, teach me about colonialism.
And that's new.
Yeah, that's a new thing. A lot of history teachers say that. And the curriculum doesn't generally give them the space for it. So they're having to improvise.
Just talking about the curriculum, teaching the kind of history that you talk about is not part of the curriculum in England. It is
at Key Stage 3. There's a bit of Empire, but not much. Yeah, Key Stage 3 has room to teach about British Empire.
You have to choose to teach it, though, don't you?
I think, yes. There's a lot of discretion involved.
There's a lot of discretion involved. And it's a huge period that you...
It's the biggest thing we ever did as a country, and it should be one of the biggest things we teach, and we don't.
Do you think that it will one day be on the curriculum? And do you think it will be in our lifetime?
Absolutely. It's happening already. I mean, the Welsh curriculum has changed.
It has.
Teaching slavery and colonialism. There's a massive movement in Scotland. I suspect that will happen within the next few years. It's an international thing that's changing in France, Germany, the Netherlands. Everything is changing when it comes to colonialism. But in England, there's a definite resistance to change.
So it's interesting. So are you saying that other European countries, former colonial rulers, do they do it better or do they do it differently?
I'm thinking in general, like the Dutch royal family have formally apologised for slavery. They've commissioned a committee of historians to look into the history. The French have commissioned really serious research into what to do with their colonial items. Germany has paid reparations. You know, they're just much more on it. And even America, there's serious conversations about reparations. But in Britain, our answer is no. We have legislation banning the return of items. You saw it at the coronation. The gap between what the Commonwealth countries wanted to talk about, reparations, return of their loot, and our total refusal to go into it. Well, I mean, King Charles did give a bit of ground, didn't he?
The Queen Consort didn't wear the Kohinoor.
Yeah, that was a kind of political dodge. Also, he said he approves of the Royal Archives being opened up to research. Yeah. But we're talking about one PhD researcher who might report by 2026. Compared to what the Dutch royal family are doing, it's ridiculously small. And compared to how much of an issue it is, even within the Commonwealth, we struggle to say what it's for, but one thing they really do want to talk about is reparations. And it's the one thing we don't want to talk about.
Mm. Do you think it's helpful to talk about decolonising the curriculum? Just that particular word, do you think that's quite a divisive word?
Yeah, I think it's divisive. I think it puts people's backs up. Also, I think ultimately it's impossible. Because if you're going to decolonise this room, first of all, we wouldn't be here. You know, you've got to undo some profound things. The wealth that slavery produced is baked into Britain. It's like trying to take the egg out of a baked cake. You can't compensate for slavery because you'd be talking about trillions. And people do try to calculate the amount of money. And we're talking trillions and trillions of pounds.
I thought that was what was very interesting, actually, in this book is when you're talking about the wealth and you talk about how empire shaped towns and cities and countryside, you really try and draw that out in places around the country so that children actually look up and look at these buildings and think about the wealth and how these buildings came to be there. Why was that important to include that?
I think with kids, you've got to relate it to their lives and probably with adults too. And that's one of the easiest ways. I mean, so many everyday items like nutmeg, HP sauce, Worcester sauce, all arguably come from Empire.
Which people wouldn't think about.
Yeah, I mean, I'm always discovering things. I discovered the other day that my English course, I did English at university, English was taught as an academic subject in India before it was taught in Britain. And actually, it was imported into Britain. A lot of the teaching materials used in India were used here. That's amazing. The idea that my English course has also had a colonial element to it. But I'm always discovering things. And I discovered things whilst researching stuff for this book, you know, which I hadn't thought about. London Zoo. I'd never thought about how that had colonial origins. You know, I didn't know that Raffles was involved in creating it. And things keep coming up all the time.
One of the most important parts of the book, which is actually a really important part of understanding Britain and multicultural Britain is the explanation of the 1948 Nationality Act, which was a kind of such a turning point moment for me and probably you too, when I realised that actually there was a piece of legislation that meant that our mums and dads, when they came over, were British citizens and that they were already British because of empire.
And not all of them.
Not all of them, but until...
Because the legislation was undone.
Of course, but initially, yeah. Until they kind of...
Fundamentally, the people on the Windrush...
And the Windrush, exactly. Came up until 1962, and then it began to be watered down. And so that when people say, go home, actually, they were British. Where would they go home to? Is that why you make a big point of it in the book? You're trying to show children this kind of longer history.
Yeah, and I think it's the most important lesson because everyone seems to have forgotten about the Windrush scandal. But our government deported British citizens to countries they didn't even know because the level of knowledge about empire was so poor amongst civil servants. That's the real world consequence of not knowing this history. And that was one of the things that the Windrush Inquiry picked up on, that we need to teach people the basic fact that black people in the 1950s and 40s came as citizens. And I still think that's really poorly understood. And I think it's partly a consequence of the media narrative, endless idea that brown people are interlopers and don't really belong. And it's amazing that that narrative persists when we have a British Asian Prime Minister, British Asian head of the SNP. It still persists, doesn't it? And it's been really bleak that the government are watering down what they're going to do about Windrush step by step. They did say they were going to take on all the recommendations of the report, and now they're not. And it's shocking. We should be more angry about it. I think people were angry for like a month, and then everyone's just forgotten about it.
But that's the direct consequence of not knowing your history. And the same was in the Stephen Lawrence report as well, wasn't it?
Yeah, it comes up regularly. It's like happens every 10 years. Everyone has a dark night of the soul. Britain feels really bad about its own racism for about 2 weeks. And then we go back to the normal narrative, which is actually we are beyond racism because we beat the evil racist Nazis. We abolished slavery. And now the narrative is we have a British Asian Prime Minister. Therefore, racism doesn't exist, has never existed. It's just not true.
What I think is really unusual about your book is you give practical advice to children who face racism or how to challenge silence about learning about empire, but also, really importantly, how to be an ally. You're giving lots of different types of kids a vocabulary. Why did you do that?
Well, I know from personal experience that it can feel very lonely having this knowledge and a lot of people not having it. It can kind of make you feel isolated. I just didn't want kids to read all this information about empire and then not know what to do with it. And I think there are constructive ways to talk about this stuff. I mean, it's too competitive, the way we talk about empire. I think you can have a debate within a school about whether Sir Richard Drax should pay reparations to the descendants of the slaves that enriched him and made him one of the richest MPs. In Parliament, you can have a debate about that without it being toxic. You can learn a lot of things and you can be on both sides. I can see both sides of that argument. So I think kids are much more flexible than we give them credit for.
You say build a statue, that you're not that into tearing down statues. What would be your statue?
I'm mainly not into tearing down statues because I feel like they're street furniture. We already think about them in recent years, right? I'll put one up for Dean Mohammed, the first Indian who ever wrote a book in English, first person to open a curry house in Britain, who ended up being a kind of massage therapist for the king in Brighton. Incredible life and kind of forgotten.
Married an Irish woman, didn't he?
He married an Irish woman, yeah. To be honest, my whole adventure into empire started with him. I thought, oh, you know what, I'll write a novel about this amazing, weird guy. And I thought, I better research what it was like to come from India and what it was like under the East India Company, because he came over with the East India Company manager of sorts. And I started researching it and that led to Empire Land. So here we are.
Oh, I didn't realise that. Mm. All down to Dean Mohammed. I've just been thinking a lot about change because people talk about apologies, they talk about reparations. You mentioned some European countries that are doing it, considering it. But could change also be the next generation, that they deal with this subject that in our lifetime has become so kind of, as you say, toxic. They just deal with it perhaps in a more adult way.
Yeah, I think there's too much focus on, we've got to change the curriculum. Curriculum doesn't matter that much because academies don't have to teach it, private schools don't have to teach it. And as we know, Wales and Scotland have different curriculums. And also, I do feel like kids are getting their knowledge from other sources, like podcasts. I mean, the Empire podcast is incredible. You've been on it, haven't you?
Yeah.
And The Rest Is History did an amazing couple of episodes on Christopher Columbus. There's Instagram accounts like The History Corridor run by a history teacher. Brown History account. I joined TikTok yesterday. Then I've got only 1,000 views of one video and probably 200 racist messages. So the view to racist abuse ratio is incredible. But kids are getting their knowledge from all sorts of different sources. And the change is happening. So people on the far right can attempt to take it on, but I think it's having no effect on the young.
Why is it at this particular moment in time? So if we think about the British Empire really drawing to an end, beginning with 1947, when they withdrew from India, why is it now, 2023, the empire is so incendiary? Why now?
I think about this a lot. It's bizarre, isn't it? Because empire ended a while ago. Why is it now one of the biggest topics in the world? Partly, I think it's, like I said earlier, the British destroyed the evidence and historians are only just discovering some of it. The Mau Mau case is a classic example. And even now, you can't get Lord Mountbatten's papers. We can't read them. And he was such an important figure for Indian independence. But on top of that, I think the first post-colonial generation, I'm thinking here of people like our parents who emigrated, but also the people running India and Nigeria and so on, they were so focused on building themselves, like building India and dealing, frankly, with all the destruction caused by the British. They didn't have energy to go over the history. And I feel like new generations have the time and luxury to sit down and actually think about it.
But maybe they feel more secure to do that as well, like their place here.
Absolutely. And I didn't think Britain would be as confident about its multiculturalism as it's become. I don't think.
And that's actually a really important thing to say, that in our lifetime, so much has changed. When we were kids, to think that you and I would be sitting here talking like this, we wouldn't have imagined it, would we?
No, I went back to my Cambridge College to talk about empire, and it was amazing that the English course has been decolonized. But it also really pissed me off because it's like, it's not fair. Why did we not have any of that? You know, it took me so long. But yeah, I mean, it's all different now, isn't it?
So if things have changed in our lifetime, maybe in our lifetime, we will also see a time where actually we are more comfortable about talking about empire and our past.
It's going to happen. I mean, in a fundamental way, truth prevails. You can't suppress the truth, man. It's going to come out. You can fight it. You can try to call these people like us woke or culture warriors and whatever. You cannot argue with the facts. You cannot argue with the consensus amongst imperial historians. That can change, but you need a lot of evidence. And so I think it's inevitable.
I just wonder, when you were that little kid in Wolverhampton, growing up in your Punjabi family, what would having had a book like this in your household have done for you?
I think it would have given me a better sense of place in Britain. It would have made me help me understand the racism that was all pervading in Wolverhampton. But it would have explained the Sikh psychology, because the Sikh identity as a martial race, which is one we've really gone for and embraced, was created by the British. The Sikh community arguably grew to large numbers in the 19th century because the British adopted us as a loyal race to fight for them after we took their side, generally, after 1857. And so much about British Sikhs can be explained by British Empire, and I don't think British Sikhs necessarily understand that, and I certainly didn't know it. No one's ever explained it to me until I found it said by historians in quite obscure books.
Satnam, thank you.
Thanks very much.
The book, Stolen History, The Truth About the British Empire and How It Shaped Us, is available in your local bookshop now. I'm Kavita Puri, and you've been watching or listening to Intelligence Squared. Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Intelligence Squared. It was produced by senior producer Connor Boyle, with editing by executive producer Rowan Slaney. We'd love to hear your feedback and what you think we should talk about next, who we should have on, and what our future debates should be. send us an email or a voice note with your thoughts to podcasts@intelligencesquared.com or tweet us @intelligence2. And if you'd like to hear more, attend some of our excellent events, or peruse over 20 years of our back catalogue, ad-free, featuring some of the world's greatest minds, then head over to intelligencesquared.com.